This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. It's been about 3 months since the virus started rapidly spreading in the United States, and much of the country went into lockdown. We wanted to use today's show to reflect on what's happened in those months with the same two people who joined us on our first show about the topic. If you have questions or comments for us today, we are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and your quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is Tom Dzinski, Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Ram Yaledi is Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network. Ram, thank you for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you.
So last time we talked to both of you, it was early March. It was March 11th, actually, which is a date that a lot of people have pointed at as sort of the turning point of the pandemic in the United States. And it was in its early stages, of course. And how do you think we're doing now compared to how you expected we might be doing at this point in mid-June? Are you pleasantly surprised? Are you disappointed? Maybe both? Ram, we'll start with you on that question. How do you feel?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. For the state of Indiana and for the city of Indianapolis, I feel much better than expected. Back in early March, we had our first COVID positive on March 6th, and a week, 10 days later, our first death. And so I was worried, quite a bit worried, frankly, that if we don't act quickly, we could end up at the same fate as Italy. And what I mean by that is where they were rationing ventilators and didn't have enough beds and doctors. So I feel very grateful that we actually avoided that in the state. Obviously, for the country as a whole, it's a very, very tragic that we had to have over 100,000 deaths. So that's not pleasant at all. And I wish that could have been avoided by more aggressive steps from a national level as well.
Do you know, could you point to what some of those steps could have been, more aggressive steps? What could we have done that might have affected the outcome in a more positive way?
Sure. I think several things. Some of these are people have already heard about, but, the idea of having people stay at home and not even cross county or state borders from a national level, I think, would have helped like it did in Italy and Spain. A shutdown is a terrible thing to do, but at least for a few weeks earlier, I think that would have helped as opposed to not doing that. But probably even more important or equally important is the whole testing issue. If we were able to ramp up an effective testing strategy nationwide, the best way, I think, instead of a shutdown is having testing and then contact tracing and isolation. And if we could have ramped up our testing to a much larger scale, what I mean by large scale is being able to do over 1 million tests a day nationwide at an earlier level, I think that could have definitely reduced the number of people that died from this disease. So I think more testing, and initially when we didn't have more testing, a more unified approach to really keeping the country locked down so people weren't. But what we see is there's high super infectors. And so these super infectious people could be traveling state to state, causing this disease to spread like it did, I think.
Dr. Yaledi, are we where we need to be right now where those two things are concerned?
We're definitely much better off. I think testing is not where it needs to be yet, but I think we made a huge progress with testing compared to 3 months ago. What I'm hopeful for, keep my fingers crossed, is by the fall when we see a resurgence, we'll have more what I call point of care testing, where you get your results within 15 minutes or at least within an hour. If we can get, which we have for influenza, by the way. So if we can get this 1 hour rapid turnaround testing ramped up fully, meaning again, doing bill to several million a day, I think that would be a significant game changer. So we don't have those yet, but we do have a lot more testing today than we did before. So I feel much better, but we're not where we need to be just yet though.
Tom Dzinski, what about you? How do you feel we're doing right now versus maybe how you expected we might feel in mid-March?
Well, I echo Dr. Yaledi's comments as well, because I think when we initially looked at this, we really had some grim outlooks, right? There's some ideas of and the number of people that were going to be infected, number of people that were going to hospitalize, and unfortunately, the number of people that we were thinking might succumb to this disease. And I think the most amazing part for me has been that in the absence of a vaccine, in the absence of solid proven treatments,
we were able to really bend that curve. You know, those simple actions of good hand washing, physical or social distancing, were able to have an effect, right? And we saw that bend actually occur. And that was great news. I mean, that alone saved countless lives. And I think my biggest concern now is I don't want people to forget that this pandemic is still ongoing, right? This virus is still out there. And unfortunately, we're still seeing new cases. We're still seeing hospitalizations and unfortunately mortality occurring because of this. So I don't want to give up the fight yet.
Well, how would you rate the state government's response here in Indiana in general to the pandemic, Tom?
I think we did fairly well, to be honest. I have to applaud like the state health department and the governor's office for gathering data, right? Doing evidence-based or data-driven policies and not just trying to figure this out without the data. So I think overall we did a pretty good job trying to act on that data so that we could provide the most up-to-date information to the citizens as we could.
What about this reopening plan? We're in the fourth of five stages right now, and we entered the fourth stage on Friday. Is there anything that you think state government should have done differently, or any ways that you think they took the right approach?
Well, I think they did it correctly by listening to the experts and looking at the data again. Now, it's up to individuals, though. We have to do our part, right? We have to, I would suggest those that are most vulnerable still maintain that physical distancing as much as they can. It's still good hand washing, you know, wearing masks in public, you know, to minimize that. So it's kind of the shared responsibility that the government has outlined a plan to reopen, but people also have to assess their own risk and do their part to minimize disease transmission.
We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic with the same two guests we had on our very first show about the coronavirus. We are with Tom Jasinski, who is Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And we also have Ram Yaledi with us. He is Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network. And Tom, I have a little bit more to ask about the epidemiological approach here. I mean, we have months of evidence now. States handling things differently around the country as well. We can point to some of that. It's got to be difficult, though, in real time to gather and analyze all that evidence. But are there concrete things that we've learned so far about the best way for states to approach this?
I think the things that we have learned is that the physical distancing actually works, right? This idea to put space between individuals will minimize and slow the transmission of the disease. When states did that, they actually were able to see a real bend in what they call the epidemic curve, right? This kind of wave that goes on. So that evidence was clear. Even in a highly infectious disease like COVID was when it arrived here in the U.S. So we knew that. We knew that hand washing and protecting the most vulnerable were the best strategies we have and still have today.
Dr. Yaledi, what have we learned about the virus and how it behaves since this started? Did we have certain ideas about it early on that proved to be wrong or maybe exaggerated?
Yeah, there's a few different things I think we're learning, and we still have a long way to go. One thing we recognize is that not everybody that's positive is equally infectious. There's some people, as I mentioned earlier, that are kind of super infectors, and other people that are positive that actually don't infect too many people. The problem is we don't know who those people are, so we know there's a whole range of individuals. The other thing we learned from our own data for the state of Indiana is that more than half, or about 50% of the deaths in the state of Indiana are from nursing homes. So one thing I do want to applaud the state government is as they did the phasing in, or the stages rather, they were very aggressive in terms of how they were working with individual nursing homes. All the nursing home residents and their staffs are to be tested regularly. And there's a lot of resources appropriately so being put into that area. So I think one of the reasons that the rollout has been reasonably effective is that they've been looking at that. They've been doing contact tracing. And so there's been a focus, so not just a blunt hammer, but a specific focus on certain areas, certain populations, to try to minimize it. But there's still a lot we need to learn. There's also some studies recently suggesting that people that are young, meaning less than age 10 or 15, may not be infectious at all, even if they're positive. So there's a lot of, and these are still preliminary, so there's a lot of things we don't know yet. But a lot of things we're learning is that it's a very heterogeneous population of people that are getting sick. And to the point about highly susceptible individuals, that those that are above 60 with comorbidities or with other health conditions definitely are the ones that we need to be most careful with. And those are the ones who should be extra cautious when they go out to a restaurant or go out to eat. And then finally, the last thing I would say in terms of learning is that clearly, as Tom was suggesting, is that social distancing, that 6 feet makes a difference. We also are seeing that if you're outside, that helps because it's the distance and the time together. So it's a lot safer, for instance, if you're going to go out to eat, to sit outside of a restaurant for an hour or two rather than inside of a restaurant. So I think we're learning that there's certain maneuvers people could take to protect themselves. And I think it's because those safety maneuvers that the state has actually been doing reasonably well. I'm quite, I was skeptical at first, but I'm really pleased at how the state has done its job and that the fact that the virus load in the hospital is actually low. We're down to 20 patients in our hospital. We're up to well over 100, 150 at one time.
Dr. Uletti, I hate to ask this question with less than a minute to go, but there was a lot of worry when this started that hospitals wouldn't be able to handle the spike in patients caused by the virus and that would have dramatic consequences on the healthcare system overall. And we saw that happen in cities like New York and Chicago. How have Indiana hospitals done?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We're very fortunate. I think the strict actions of a shutdown for the state and the city and the county of Marion County made all the difference. We were very well prepared. I think all the hospitals in central Indiana and the state as a whole had developed developed massive plans, had databases where we're all feeding data into how many ventilators, how many beds, how many staff we have available. So I think we're very prepared. Thank goodness it didn't happen, but we feel we're in a very, very good shape, or best as we can be, I suppose, if we were that to happen.
After a quick break, we will be back with our update on the COVID-19 pandemic with Tom Dzinski, Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, and Ram Yaledi, Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network, who we just heard from. If you have questions for our guests today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana and in the country. And as always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. We have two guests with us. Tom Dzinski is Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, and Ram Yaledi is Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network. These are the same two guests we had on with us on March 11th. And speaking of voicemails, we do have a listener voicemail. This one comes from TA in Indianapolis, who has a question for Tom. Let's listen.
As we move forward, could we benefit from an analysis of the genomes of those who have been infected, with special emphasis on people who became very sick and those who died? If those two groups would exhibit common genetic markers, especially in the pulmonary and immune systems, it might be an indicator for those who would suffer the most from the future infection from COVID-19. That group could then be designated to be among the first to receive vaccines as they become available. This could help take the pressure off the healthcare system and save lives. There's a great deal of genetic information already out there, and more could be developed. Thanks for the opportunity, and good luck to everyone.
Tom, how possible might TA's suggestions be?
It is possible. I don't know if we necessarily need to go to that extent, because we knew, and we still know today, those who are at most risk. The very older, as you age with every decade of life, your immune system tends to weaken.
and isn't as robust as, say, somebody in their 20s, right? So pile on top of that then any comorbid condition, things like cardiovascular disease or diabetes or hypertension also puts you at greatest risk. So I think there's going to be a lot more genetic studies coming out looking at this pandemic. But in the meantime, we could use the evidence that we currently have to protect the most vulnerable if and when a vaccine actually becomes available. Certainly the recommendations of the most vulnerable are going to be get the vaccine first and then work our way down from there.
Tom, one of the most common sentiments we've seen from people around the country in response to the advice and the guidelines coming from CDC and the World Health Organization and others is confusion. A lot of people want to do things safely, and they've heard totally different advice from health officials about the efficacy of face masks, for example. Have you noticed this? And if so, why do you think it's happening?
I think some of the confusion came here initially when we said, don't use face masks. Face masks aren't effective. And then we did the about face on those, right? So that, yes, wear a mask. Covering your nose and your mouth. And when we change messages like that kind of midstream, it does say, well, you told us before not to wear a mask, and now you're telling us to wear a mask. And the reality is this is something new in the population. We've never seen this virus before. We've never had it affect an entire globe. So as we learn more information, some of the messaging may actually change, right? So as we discover more about this virus, as we understand its modes of transmission and how to best protect people, our messaging may change. And I think that's what happened and certainly lends to the confusion.
Are you worried, though, that one result of that for a lot of people could be a diminished level of trust in health officials?
I think that's always a challenge, right? We, as a public health professional, we want to be right. We want to be first with the information out. But we have to recognize that we don't know everything as it's occurring, right? That we have to gather information. We have to gather data. And these messages, you know, throughout history have proven that we sometimes get it incorrect and we'll try and correct it as we go. It's definitely going to affect the trust of some individuals. But I think this idea that if we're all in the same voice, that yes, you know, we're all saying now that the masks are effective, that social distancing is effective, that's important to help build that trust back up.
Ron Mulledy, what is it like right now for people who test positive in Indiana?
So it depends, and the reason I say that is that if you're getting tested and you're symptomatic versus asymptomatic, one of the things that when the state of Indiana did their own survey of 5,000 individuals, we found about close to 45% of the people were asymptomatic. And so, getting back to your previous question, you know, the idea of wearing masks and not wearing masks, one thing we learned is that there's a significant number of people that have the virus that are potentially contagious, but don't know it, and so that's the reason to wear a mask. So if you're to your question about if you test positive, I think the most prudent thing is to quarantine yourself. It's very important that that you really restrict yourself from getting in contact with others because it still is a highly contagious disease. And then depending on your age, if you're younger versus older, you'll have different types of symptoms from it. And, some people are completely asymptomatic, but some people are more symptomatic. So you need to call your physician, talk to them, and isolate yourself for at least 14 days or until your symptoms are better. I still think that's very, very important because people can't forget that it's still just as contagious today as it was March 11.
What is the current status, Dr. Yeletti, on drug treatments for the virus?
We're making some headway, not as far as I'd like it to be, but pretty far given it's only been a few months. There are currently only one approved drug called remdesivir from Gilead. That drug may be a benefit, but the only thing it actually has shown so far is it reduces the number of days you're in a hospital. It likely reduces the risk of dying, but that's not clear just yet. What's positive and hopeful for me, though, is there's probably another at least a dozen drugs that are in what I call phase two trials to really attack the virus. I do feel confident that by the fall, we'll have some strategies. The virus has, if people have seen pictures of the coronavirus, they see these little spikes on this little round ball. So there's these antibodies that attack those spikes. And even Lilly here in town has actually developed an antibody drug that attacks those spikes that we're actually actively enrolling patients right now in the city. So we're not where we need to be yet. We only have one approved drug, but by the fall, I suspect we'll have significantly a lot more drugs available to treat our patients.
Tom Daczynski, what about a vaccine? I remember when we asked about this in March, you and Dr. Ulletti suggested that a vaccine at that point was anywhere from 12 to 18 months away. How close could we be to a vaccine being released, knowing what we know now?
That's an interesting question, because I know a lot of companies are working towards a vaccine and several trials are underway currently. I would say we're at least 6 to 12 months away still from a vaccine that could be widely distributed in the U.S.
Can you explain what the process is like for a vaccine to be approved and released?
Absolutely. So any new drug or vaccine has to go through clinical trials, right? This idea that we want to make sure that this drug is not only effective, but it's safe. And will work in a largest percentage of the population as possible. So the first trial is basically, you know, is this drug or vaccine going to do any harm, right? And will it work on what we want it to do? We test that on a small number of people in the U.S. or in a population or in a sample. Then if it's proven to be effective and safe, we try it on a larger population, looking for any side effects and understanding, is it still working on this larger group of people now before we move into the final phase of a much larger sample, and then collecting data on that and on those individuals as well, to show that, yes, it's not only safe, but it actually does what we say it's going to do, which in this case would prevent infection from coronavirus.
We are talking about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic with Tom Daczynski, Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, and Ram Ulletti, Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network. These are the same two gentlemen who joined us on March 11th on our first show about the what was then, I think, not quite defined yet as a pandemic, but it may have been that very day. That was a day that we looked at as sort of a turning point. And Tom, some of the stories that I've read about vaccines suggest that some of the vaccines or possible vaccines that are in trials right now could be ready as soon as September or October. How valid are some of those claims that we've been hearing and reading about in the news?
Yeah, I haven't seen those yet. To say that that's actual, like a valid and actual claim. I mean, it would be really quick turnaround if that were the case. And as long as they're following the FDA's guidelines on clinical trials and reporting all that data out, then those vaccines would meet the criteria to be released. I haven't really seen that yet, though.
Is there any way, though, that process of developing a vaccine could be tweaked to help things go faster, or indeed has there?
The FDA has the ability to kind of speed those processes up, especially in a pandemic like we're experiencing now. But again, get back to your earlier point of trust, we have to get this right. You know, history is full of several examples when we didn't get it right. So in order to rebuild that trust and gain that trust of the population, we have to get these things right. We have the ability to social distance. We have the ability to wear masks and things like that, which will help us and will buy us time until a vaccine that's safe and effective can be brought to market.
I might want to make one comment.
Go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for the listeners, I think we need to really let them know that there will be no vaccine this year. I think in order to get, they have about five different ones that they're trying now. The most promising one is called an RNA vaccine, which we've never used before. Keep in mind, the fastest vaccine we got from initial phase one to out there was Ebola, and that took 5 years. To develop what we need that's effective, I think we just need to set expectations that the earliest would be first quarter of next year, and that I don't want people to get lulled into this thing that things will go away this fall. And to, you know, to Tom's point, we need to make sure we have trust in with the healthcare system. And the worst thing you could do is get out something that doesn't work. And so they're in phase two trials, but to get through phase three, it's just the amount of, everybody's obviously putting in literally billions of dollars to do it. Meaning once you get it, then again, you have to actually have 3 billion plus vials of this ready to go. And so there's the logistics of even developing it. So a lot of companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Bloomington is already ramping up their facilities to ramp up these vials of doses. But there's too many variables to really make a practical be this year. And I just need to understand that.
We have another listener voicemail. This one is from Sunny in Lafayette with a question about contact tracing. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Sunny calling from Lafayette. I wonder about the contact tracing and our need for privacy. Please, can you report which sites rather than persons are shown to be places of contact and exposure? For example, we were all allowed to go to the grocery store. Many people didn't wear masks to protect me and still don't. So I need to know more about where the exposures have been. I went through Indianapolis. I saw a lot of people not wearing masks on Friday, sorry to say. Thank you.
Tom, can we help Sunny out? What do we know?
So the way contact tracing works is if an individual is identified as a case, so you got a test and you came back positive, a public health representative would contact that individual and interview them, ask them, you know, where have you been? Who have you been around? Can you identify these people? How long were you around them? Were they wearing masks? Were they not? And then we would contact those individuals. We would also list or track the locations that you were. So if you visited a particular supermarket or a home improvement center, right, we would have those lists as well. We then reach out to each of those individuals, those individual contacts that you identified. So, you know, I was with Susie or I was with Bill or as whomever, and say that you may have been exposed. Now, in order to protect privacy, we don't ever reveal who the case was or who you may have exposed. We just say that you may have been exposed, and we would ask you to, you know, isolate for the next 2 weeks or unless you develop signs and symptoms to reach out to your family doctor to do that. But public health can look at those locations, and then if we see a increase in number of cases that are associated with a particular location, we could reach out to that location and ask them what factors or logistical things they have in place, such as do they have shields up? Are they requiring people to wear masks when they enter their store? Are the employees wearing masks? Are they cleaning between customers? So that information is there, can be utilized by public health, but also has to be protected by public health.
Dr. Ioletti, I want to follow up on your follow-up on the question of a vaccine. And what I want to ask you about is, of course, related to my question to Tom, where I referenced stories that I've read about vaccines possibly being available in September and October. What are your thoughts on how the media has covered this? And what effect do you think that's had? Are we being too optimistic in some cases?
Yeah, it is a fine line. I think, you know, everybody's really anxious to try to see some hope and optimism on how we get out of this. And so the media hears from healthcare advisors that we won't be out of this crisis of COVID-19 until there's a vaccine. And so everybody's anxious to see how quickly that could happen. So there is a media hype. And I'm not trying to blame anybody in particular. People are just very anxious and want to see something. And so whenever there's a small glimmer of hope that some company either in the United States or some around the world might have a vaccine by the fall, people just get very excited about it. But I just think we need to have a reality check with it, is that the chance of that happening is very slim. And so I don't want to raise people's hopes, but to just really manage expectations. The flip side of it, though, is I think people need to understand. I do think if, when coronavirus comes back in the fall, we're going to be in a different environment. What I mean by that is we will have more drugs that actually will treat people, but we also will have a lot more testing. So I think the environment where we will not need to do any kind of a massive shutdown like we had to before when we had nothing in our toolkit. We will have more tools, not the ideal ones, but definitely have more tools. So I don't want people to fear that the fall is going to be worse than it was in the spring. I do think the fall, when it comes back, it may still be just as contagious, but we'll have a lot more better ways to handle it and not shut down the entire country. So vaccine is the ultimate solution, but in between there, we have different solutions that can work, I think. And one last thing I might make about the contact tracing, for somebody that might drive down to Indianapolis, one of the things about this disease we're going to see in the next few months is what I call hotspots. We're not going to see the entire state of Indiana get it, but hotspots. And hotspots typically will occur when you're in a small, closed environment for a prolonged period of time. So if you go to your grocery store, walk around and leave, there's a chance you may get it. But if you're sitting in a restaurant or a church or someplace for a couple hours where nobody's wearing masks and sitting close proximity, there's a higher likelihood of that. You know, there was a hotspot with the choir back in Washington State a few weeks ago. So the key to not contact tracing, but to protect yourself is beware of staying in closed space for a long period of time.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Ron Muletti is Chief Physician Executive at Community Health Network, and Tom Dzinski is Director of Epidemiology Education at IUPUI. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. For our last segment today, we're shifting gears to talk about mental health and the impact racism and conversations about racism can have on people. And to help us do it, we're joined by Danielle Henderson, a clinical psychologist at IU Health. Danielle, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
And a quick note, this segment was pre-taped earlier today, so unfortunately we can't take your questions and comments live, but we would still love to hear what you think about this. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and leave us a comment. Danielle, to start out, can you tell us about the work that you do as a clinical psychologist and how you came to focus on this specific issue?
Sure. Well, I have been with IU Health for almost 2 years now. I actually came to Indianapolis for my internship in psychology through IU School of Medicine, and then stayed on for a fellowship in adult health psychology, particularly working with patients who were candidates for transplant, and then had the opportunity to be asked to join the faculty with IU School of Medicine and IU Health in 2018. So in my work, I work primarily with adults in a variety of settings. I have an outpatient setting where I see patients, and then I also work in a pain clinic a couple of days a week and a primary care clinic as well.
And so do you then have a focus on racism or a focus on trauma caused by outside sources like that?
It's not necessarily my focus, but over the past few months or so, it's definitely come up. And as different national events have occurred throughout my graduate training and internship and postdoc training, definitely reflecting more on the impact of racism on mental health and having conversations about this with my colleagues and sometimes patients as well.
Does it seem to be a growing problem?
I don't know about a growing problem, but I feel that over the last couple of weeks, I've definitely been having more conversations about it than I ever have throughout, my training or career. People are wanting to know, how to have these conversations, feeling more open about sharing some experiences they've had. And that's been very interesting for me to be part of and observe over these last few weeks.
So then what mental health issues can you see happening to people who experience racism?
Sure. Well, there have been many studies that have shown that racism has been linked to anxiety, depression, overall psychological distress, and trauma symptoms, like you mentioned earlier. Particularly, I can go through each of those, particularly with anxiety. When we think about anxiety, usually when we're anxious about something, we can avoid it. So if you think about if you're anxious about crowds, you can very easily avoid that. But with racism, there's no opportunity to avoid or modify our lives. And then we're never really sure when a racist experience or an experience of racism might occur, from whom it might come. And so that might lead one to be fearful, anxious, and on edge about this, or worry about it. When thinking about depression, so we often find that anxiety and depression are co-occurring. And so similarly, when we encounter racism, it can be a very difficult experience. Usually it's something we've experienced throughout our lives. It's not usually just one event. It's happened many times in our lives. And this could possibly lead us to feel down or hopeless and, you know, have a lack of interest in engaging in things that we might usually enjoy. And interestingly, one study that was done back in 2018 found that they were examining police killings specifically and their spillover effects on the mental health of Black Americans. And the study found that there were more poor mental health days associated with those events than poor mental health days associated with diabetes. So I think that really drives home the impact, particularly for Black Americans, of witnessing and seeing police killings and the impact that it has on one's mental health, such to the degree that it's impacting one's ability to work or feel comfortable going to work.
Well, let's talk about the word trauma, which, you know, we can kind of associate this with, and we see that word used sometimes in reference to the impact that racism can have on people. And I guess, can you explain what trauma is in this context and what effect it has?
Sure. So with trauma, it's being exposed to a life-altering event. That's the way I try to describe it. Particularly with, you know, racism, maybe one way to think about it would be, was something done to you or something said to you that you would never want to have happen to someone else and your family or someone else that you love. You know, again, when we think of trauma, we have different events that come to mind, you know, natural disasters or personal insults, if you will, or witnessing different violent events. And so we definitely have that in our culture right now, with things being posted on social media and these different videos going viral. But then also in our daily lives, in addition to watching those videos or being exposed to those things, then it can also mean, you know, comments said to us, ways in which people have behaved with us. And so again, with racism, one might have similar symptoms that you would with PTSD. So you think about being afraid, so having heightened fear, hypervigilance, so feeling like you have to constantly be on guard and prepared for something like this to happen again. Often when people have experienced acts of racism, they might also experience shame or feelings of guilt, and then self-blame. And another part with, particularly with racism, is that oftentimes the experience may not be validated. So then there's that also, that the added layer of, am I overreacting? Did I misinterpret? Is it me? And having difficulty, have a feeling that validation from people with whom you might share your experience.
I mean, these are complicated issues that can be really tough and sometimes impossible to even just define, and even harder to measure. How difficult is it to research something like this?
You know, that's not my wheelhouse, actually. So I can't speak to the difficulty, but I do feel, you know, there are definitely trauma scales that we use in our practice quite often that assess your symptoms of PTSD. I think, again, just, this is not my specific line of research, but just thinking about work as a clinician, again, we might be more primed to think about other types of events as trauma and miss racism, and maybe not ask direct questions about one's experience with racism and how that may or may not have impacted you and your perception of what that event has been like for you in your life. And then similarly with our patients, patients might not always feel comfortable sharing these experiences with us. Again, often they've had many examples of racism or experiences throughout their lives. And so it might not even really be present for them. And so I think it can kind of go both ways with us as a clinician, you know, expanding our view of what trauma can mean and experiences that our patients can be having. And then also for our patients, hopefully that we're helping them feel comfortable sharing some of these experiences with us. Because again, in my opinion, that's one of the beautiful things about therapy is that we can talk about some really difficult issues and topics.
We are talking about the impact that racism and conversations about racism can have on people's mental health. And we are doing that with Danielle Henderson, a clinical psychologist at IU Health. And Danielle, so let's move right into that. What options do people have to cope with these mental health issues?
So this, I'm glad you asked that question. I think it's so important. So one, I think it's important for people to know that you can cope. There are many, many avenues to take. I'll start with maybe some of the smaller things. Being intentional in carving out space for yourself, some downtime, making sure that you're prioritizing as best you can your rest, your physical activity, your eating, your nutrition. With the busyness of your day and, you know, added thoughts on your mind, it's very easy to maybe not eat enough or too much or not get enough water. So really trying to focus on those things. Again, when you are trying to find some sort of coping practice, it's trial and error. It might take doing things a couple times or doing a combination of things a couple times for you to find what works for you. It's definitely not one size fits all. So I always encourage people, you know, what do you enjoy? Is it listening to music? Is it listening to a show on the radio that you really enjoy and that brings you pleasure? Talking to your friends, making time for fun. So it might feel hard and might not feel like something you want to do, but watching a funny TV show or a movie, sharing memes. And I think also knowing your capacity to handle what's going on right now. If you are noticing, maybe I need a break from social media, take that break and maybe talk to a friend. Hey, I feel some effects from, you know, being online constantly or being exposed to the news. I'm going to just maybe check once a week, or I'm just going to check once a day. If anything significant happens, can you please, you know, give me a call and let me know if there's news I must know, you know, please let me know. That's a great way of staying informed, but you not having to be exposed to it. And then I also, again, I have to say, if you have any concerns about your mental health or other people have concerns about your mental health, without delay, you know, please seek help now. There are so many qualified mental health professionals here in Indianapolis and in the surrounding area. You know, again, I'd hate for someone to feel that, you know, this is just going to go away, or my family's always had difficulties, this is just how it is for us. It doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to normalize some of these more difficult experiences, and there is help available. And I also tell people too, when you start with therapy, it's a relationship like any other. And so it might not be the right fit with someone, and that's okay. I, as a clinician, understand that and try to take that gracefully if someone feels as if they could be better benefited with working with someone else.
But in order to get to that point, you have to identify the issue in the first place. Do you think that enough people know how to identify that they're suffering in the first place and that they need to do something?
You know, that's an excellent question. That's a good question. So on one hand, I want to say I always encourage people to, maybe if you're not quite sure, I always encourage someone to maybe talk to a trusted friend or mentor about what you're experiencing. Also talk to your doctor, maybe like your primary care physician. You know, hey, this is what I've been going through over these last few weeks. What do you think? And then you can have, you know, start that conversation. And then, you know, often your primary care doctor could refer you to a mental health professional or give you some initial resources that you can read yourself to then kind of help you decide, do I need to establish care with a mental health professional? You know, online is great for looking up mental health symptoms and figuring out what it is you might be experiencing. But again, for me personally, I encourage, that's part of my job as well, is to you to come in, this is what's going on. I reflect what I hear back and then say, okay, based on what you're sharing with me, this is what I think it might be. So there is, I can understand that feel that I have to have it all figured out so that I can share it with the therapist. But again, from my perspective, that's my job to help you do that, to help you kind of make sense of everything you've been experiencing.
Let's talk about a variable that a lot of us deal with every single day, social media. And it's a huge part of life for people right now. And there are different platforms that work in different ways, of course, but maybe the most common trait between all of them is this deluge of content that users get. And it can be an incredible amount of imagery and information to process. When that content is about important but upsetting things and people see those things a lot, what do we know about the effect that that can have?
I mean, it can definitely cause one to become distressed, become anxious, become, like I was saying, you know, feelings of depression or feeling down or hopeless. Social media, I mean, in a lot of ways is wonderful, but it can definitely have some negative effects on our mental health. So I think I always try to encourage people to be aware of what you're experiencing physically, mentally, emotionally when you get online. Are there different sensations you feel in your body when you look at certain posts or images? And being aware of that, and maybe if you can't name it, that's okay. But I think, you know, being aware of what you notice when you're online and then also when you're offline, are you finding that it's hard to stop thinking about some of the things that you've read or seen, or maybe it's even hard to go to sleep or stay asleep because those images keep going through your mind? Just, you know, take note of that. And then, if you're noticing that it's causing some interference or difficulty with your life, as best you can, taking a break, maybe a full break from social media, maybe deciding to check it at a different time of the day. If you realize, okay, when I check it before bed, that really disrupts my sleep, let me try it in the middle of the day. Or if I check it in the morning, that can disrupt the rest of my day. So let me figure out maybe a better time that I can do this. Or again, like I said, maybe it might be time for a full break, and that's perfectly understandable as well.
Are there any, in our last 30 seconds, I'm sorry to say, are there any misconceptions you see popping up a lot in conversations around mental health issues and the larger issues that we're focusing on?
I think one of the biggest things is, since we're focusing on racism and mental health, I think one of the biggest things is maybe a misconception that racism is no longer a problem, and that's not true. And also, if maybe people haven't talked about racism, then that means they haven't experienced it, and that's not true as well. So I think the best we can do is recognize it as a problem and listen to the experiences of those who are sharing with us and try not to rush to judgment.
Danielle Henderson is a clinical psychologist at IU Health. Danielle, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. Find us there. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galan. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.